Hi, and welcome to the Plant-Based Recruiter Podcast. This is the first in a series of interviews with influential plant-based leaders. I want to learn about their journeys, what motivates them, and how their companies are making a difference in the world. First up is Christopher Kong, co-founder of Better Nature, the world's first food tech company focused solely on tempeh fermentation. Chris's story is amazing. He's a degree from Oxford University in molecular biochemistry and has recently just raised over £1.6 million in funding for the company. Here we cover a range of topics from boxing to the effects of plastic on environmental degradation. I hope you enjoy it and let me know your feedback. Chris, well, thanks so much for joining me today. So you're one of the co-founders of Better Nature and also the head of business development. For those of you who don't know, Better Nature is the world's first food tech company focused on tempeh fermentation, which is an ancient food processing technology which produces high protein meat alternatives. So, yeah, what's not to like, eh?
You've got it. You've got it. No, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
Great. And I was looking at the kind of the accolades that you've received as a company already. You know, you've been in Forbes, Telegraph, The Grocer, and won 4 food tech competitions already. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it is 4. I can't quite remember, and I'm not just saying that, like, but something like that. Yeah.
Fantastic. So it's obviously, you know, quite a story. So can you start by telling me a bit about your journey to co-founding the company, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess it all really started when I applied for this random biotech conference that was taking place at the University of Cambridge. And it was the conference was called the GAP Summit. And what the GAP Summit was all about was largely a biotech / pharmaceutical conference, but it was more to get all these leaders of tomorrow, as they called them. So 100 students from around the world that applied and were selected to participate in this physical conference to learn about all the different gaps within the biotech industry. Okay. And to propose solutions to fill those gaps. And it was an epic 3-day event with amazing lectures and discussions led by the C-suites of, you know, the world's largest pharmaceutical and biotech companies. And as part of this conference, about 2 months before the conference, they sort of grouped up the 100 delegates into teams of 5. And in these teams of 5, they assigned us a mentor and told us that we have 2 months to come up with a business idea, to come up with a business plan, to create a really engaging pitch. And the top 7 teams of the 20 teams would then be able to pitch on the main stage of this conference. And the winner would get some money, not huge amounts, I think it was about £5,000, okay, to start the business. So at that time, I was in my final year of university, I applied, and I just so happened to be put into the same team as one of our now co-founders, Amadeus, who, yeah, at that time was doing his PhD on tempeh fermentation, and I was doing my master's in biochemistry. So, we were randomly grouped up, and we had a introductory Google Meets call, and we just got on so well from day one. And we were, I think, spiritually aligned. And spirituality is not often discussed in the business world.
No.
Right? But I think it's really important when finding other partners and other people you want to spend Absolutely. So much time with. You know, you can't just be aligned on the commercial aspects of the business. You also need to be aligned on a more deeper level. And for lack of a better word, I sort of just call that spirituality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we both saw ourselves coming from positions of great influence. There are not many people, for example, that graduate from the University of Oxford every year, yet there are countless problems in the world that need to be solved imminently. And, you know, if not us, then who? So that was sort of the approach that we had. And just so great to have met someone, to meet someone that shared exactly those same thoughts. And we brainstormed different ideas, and Better Nature, well, the embryonic, very, very early stages of what Better Nature is today stemmed from those initial discussions and from winning that competition at the GAP Summit.
Oh wow! So and you won the competition as well.
Yeah, it was super fun. I mean, it wasn't easy. We worked super, super hard, and we were up against some amazing, amazing other teams. And I think some other teams are still, you know, pushing the ideas forward and have actually become, you know, established businesses in their own right. So, but yeah, we just got lucky on the day.
That's amazing. And were you vegetarian or vegan at this point, or is that a journey that you kind of gone on since?
So I was a transitioning vegetarian.
Okay.
At that point.
Yeah.
I think it just became apparent to me, largely because of Ellen. So Ellen being our head of marketing and a fellow co-founder of Bed Nature, we were in the same college together at university, and she was a diehard vegan. You know, she'd been vegan, I think by that point, for at least 3 or 4 years, and a vegetarian for many more years before, 7 or 8 years before. And I guess she was so convincing that before long, our entire friendship group became either vegan or vegetarian.
Oh, wow. She really is influential. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I myself, I grew up in Hong Kong. And in Hong Kong, meat, and we're in Chinese culture, really, meat is everything. It's the center of the plate. You don't have a meal without meat.
Okay.
And so when I first started at uni, and, you know, I went to boarding school here in the UK, but even there, like, you know, everyone was eating meat. There was no consideration even for someone who was vegetarian or vegan. I don't know what they did for people that didn't want to eat meat.
Okay.
Yeah. I have no idea. It just wasn't part of our vocabulary, you know, being vegetarian or vegan. But going to university, that, you know, really opened up my eyes. And, you know, Ellen, obviously, the message that she preached, I then watched Cowspiracy. And before long, I just found myself thinking, you know, why the heck am I eating beef? You know, there's no use for this, and it's awful. So I stopped eating beef and then stopped eating pork. And it just sort of snowballed into me being, basically vegetarian by the time I started, by the time this conference took place. This was in the spring of 2018. And then became fully vegan that summer, summer of 2018.
Because I read somewhere that you were a keen boxer as well at university. Did you manage to convert any of your boxing team to the vegetarian or vegan ways?
Unfortunately not. I mean, you know, I got asked, you know, why, you know, surely this will impact your performance, surely, you know, this, that, and the other. But I won my fight. You know, I was only one of three people from the Oxford side to win the fights, and worked super hard, you know. Had to lose a lot of weight. So trying to adopt a plant-based diet while trying to lose, I think, about 7 kilos to make weight.
To make the weight category, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And for the last 2 weeks, couldn't eat any fiber. So I was relying on dense sort of broccoli, you know, so not nutritionally dense, but physically dense foods to make myself feel full enough to go to bed in order to make weight. But all this physically dense foods contain fibers, and I had to cut them out. So that was painful. But I did it. I did it and won my fight, and it was a unanimous victory. So I did vegans everywhere, or vegetarians everywhere.
You did them a service. Yeah. Great stuff. Mm-hmm. So from talking about sort of packing the protein, can you tell me a bit more, Chris, about the fermentation process? I know you've kind of got a few patents, so you might not be able to go into too much detail, but that really interests me. What's the story behind that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, tempeh fermentation is actually a 300-year-old technology. Wow. It originated in Java, which is the main central island of Indonesia. And essentially, it involves cooked soybeans and fungal starter cultures, so spores from indigenous fungi, mushrooms, and it is just the marriage of plant protein and mushroom protein. So what happens is that the mushroom spores sporulate and they grow around the plant-based protein. So for us, that's soybeans. And as they grow, they wrap up the soybeans in this matrix, or in this sort of spongy material that it is itself made of pure protein, and that's its mycelium. That's effectively the body, the underground portion of the mushroom that no one ever sees. And that then, you know, they secrete all sorts of different enzymes which digest away the fats and digest away the carbohydrates of the plant-based protein. So for us, the soybeans, and, you know, produce protein. And in fact, a completely, you know, a complete source of protein, a source of protein that has all the essential amino acids that one needs to live healthily. And after about 24 hours, you end up with tempeh, which is a, you know, perfectly fermented block of soybeans and mushroom protein, which can then be sliced and diced and marinated and cooked in all the ways that meat is traditionally prepared. I guess how this really differs from, say, tofu is that, you know, with tofu, you're just using the milk of the soybeans. Mm-hmm. So you go through a milling process, you extract milk, and then you just coagulate the milk. So you denature all the proteins such that they sort of curdle up. Okay. But with this fermentation process, you're leveraging so much more of the bean. And because you retain all the fiber or most of the fiber of that bean, you have this like structural backbone to the product that can mimic the bite and the mouthfeel of meat in the same way that many, many other all natural meat alternatives cannot.
Yeah. I think it's an amazing story, isn't it? That it's a process which is so ancient, but to, you know, to bring it up to the present time and the work that you're doing at Better in Nature, it's great. So Chris, just with your background, I know you were involved in kind of early stage startups prior to Better Nature. Did they kind of shape your decisions that you've made within the business, would you say?
Yes, absolutely. I think, when I say when I was involved with early stage startups, it was made, you know, I was doing this alongside my degree. Okay. So it wasn't ever to the same extent. It wasn't ever, you know, a full-time job. It was just more really of a hobby. You know, though I loved, and I still do love biochemistry, I couldn't see myself working 9 to 5 or however long you need to work in a lab doing those sort of experiments. And that sort of lifestyle just wasn't for me. I thought it was a little bit too slow.
Okay.
And, you know, coming from a back, you know, both my parents, for example, are serial entrepreneurs. Okay. And it's something, and I understand the struggle of that sort of lifestyle. I understand, I appreciate the uncertainty, but I can also appreciate the joy and fulfillment that they get from the work that they do because it is their own work. And so from a very young age, I've always wanted to be a creator or a inventor. In fact, my first dream job when I was about 8 or 7 or 8 was to be an inventor. I just wanted to create things and bring them to market. I guess the sad reality of working in a lab is that you rarely see how your research translates into real world impact. By sitting behind, you know, a bench. You know, that sort of that visibility only really comes from people. I don't know. For most innovations, it never happens.
No.
Most research projects, it just ends with a paper that's been published and that's it. And I really wanted to sit between the science and the world. You know, I wanted to be able to say that I took this technology. Maybe I wasn't the person that invented it, but you know, I took this technology to the market and as a result benefited people and the planet and animals as a result. So, so I appreciate we've completely sidetracked from the question.
No, that's all.
I guess for me, you know, my primary motivation to get involved with business development, and I just wanted to sink my teeth in and get as much experience as possible. So, you know, at that time, Oxford perhaps wasn't the most entrepreneurial university in the world, but it's certainly improving. But I just so happened to find myself working with some amazing people who are still now in the startup world. And was able to offer them an extra pair of hands, another brain, and at the same time was also looking into consulting. So working for strategy consultants and management consultancy firms to really hone that craft of business development. You know, I come from a science background. I've literally got no clue how businesses worked at that time and really wanted to learn and really wanted to be able to make myself the best person to sit between the innovation at the bench to real world, you know, to the real world application. And I just found myself in all sorts of odd jobs and helping other businesses out wherever I could. And, you know, actually I applied for, I won't mention them by name, but, you know, probably the most famous strategy consulting firm. And as an intern and, you know, did that. And I had an amazing time, met some amazing people, but just realized it wasn't for me. I didn't want to help other businesses that perhaps weren't doing the best thing. That, you know, and these other businesses, you don't know what impact they're having on the environment and the people. And a lot of these businesses of recent, you know, actually months have come under fire for doing things unethically. And I didn't want to be involved in that. I'd much rather do something for myself so that I could know exactly what's going in, what's coming out, and the impact that's having. So, didn't take up the offer, the full-time job offer in the end. And this is all preceded, I guess, founding Better Nature. But I think what it did teach me from the very, it was not an easy decision to make. In fact, Better Nature was, had been incorporated for about 8 months before I fully turned down the offer. But I think what that experience taught me was you just gotta go with your gut, and you shouldn't listen. You know, people's feedback is important. People's advice is important.
You gotta listen to your own.
Exactly.
Your own voice. Yeah.
You gotta listen to your own voice and just back yourself. Who was I to believe as a 22-year-old that I could potentially change the world? But that's something I've always wanted. I don't know, maybe not changing the world is a big statement, but I was able to actually help people. But I wanted to, and I thought that Better Nature was the best way for me to do that. So I just went in, and who knows if it actually turns out to be, you know, the right decision. We'll never know.
You won't know unless you give it a try, will you? So
exactly. And I've had a phenomenal time. Learned amazing things, met amazing people. So no regrets.
Well, we were speaking before we started recording just about the fast-paced nature of the business and, you know, the ongoing challenges that you're facing. So it sounds like you're really thriving, and, you know, you feel like you've made the right decision. And it's obviously a really exciting time for Better Nature as well, in terms of the investment that you've just raised. So I know you completed a funding round on Cedars for over £1.5 million. I think it was just over a week that you got all the investment, which was over 120% of what you were looking for. So that was a phenomenal response. Did you expect it to be quite that adamant?
Absolutely not. We had secured about 1.3 million of the 1.6 that we're looking for from outside investors before we went on Cedars.
Okay.
Cedars was just an unparalleled opportunity for us to not only get the name of Better Nature out there, but to, in a way, I guess, solidify the community that we've built, right? And to get social media followers or our newsletter followers, our customers, you know, involved in the business, to make them feel truly part of what we were trying to do here at Better Nature. So that's why we went on Cedars, and we just did not expect just how warm the audience was going to be. You know, typically Cedars gives 1 week to businesses to raise privately, so off the campaign.
Yes.
So for example, for the first 7 of the 8 days that you mentioned, you couldn't actually see us on Cedars. If you went on Cedars and you searched Better Nature, you wouldn't actually be able to see us. The only way people could invest in those 7 days is if we shared a link with them prior and they signed up via that link. And in that 7 days alone, from the people that we had, you know, had to sign up through this link, that we, you know, we didn't run any marketing on social media or anything about because it just didn't make sense. It was just through newsletters, our newsletter on social media.
And so literally just from existing customers and people that have bought the product and knew of you organically, as it were.
Exactly. From that alone, we had hit 90% or 95% of our target. And that was within the first 7 days, such that when we actually went live on Cedars to the wider Cedars community, we weren't like we were there for 48 hours. We were literally there for 2 days. It was done.
That's incredible. And in terms of the plans for the capital that you've raised, what are the priorities with those funds then, Chris?
Yeah, it's super exciting. And to have the money in the bank and to be able to execute on the roadmap that we have. It is a very, very packed schedule. Okay. It's just impossible it's going to be very busy, but really, really exciting. And I think the priorities are for us to really establish ourselves as a mainstream meat-free brand. We've done really well online, phenomenally well on platforms like Amazon, through our own online store, but we want to be a go-to brand for people looking for all natural meat alternatives, for meat, delicious and natural meat-free products that consumers can eat on a daily basis and not necessarily feel bad about it because they appreciate and they can see very simply what goes in. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of obscurity and there's a lack of transparency in the meat-free category, just generally speaking. And I want, here at Better Nature, we want to bring products that would just invite more people into the category. So so it's really nailing the launch of our brand new range of products, which will be available to purchase in June.
Great.
On our website to start off with. But we're having exciting conversations with all the biggest retailers here in the UK, of course, support that launch with the necessary marketing and brand building, and to invest into developing new products because we're really just scratching the tip of the iceberg, or scratching the surface of the vision that we have for Tempeh with this new range of 4 products, and there's just so much more that we have. So many more ideas that we love to explore, and we can't wait to take those products to our customers too.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. I mean, I think, like you say, the plant-based space is very, very competitive, but the Tempeh offering is something different, and all the products that you mentioned in the roadmap are, they do look exciting, and they do look to offer something different that the market doesn't have. And I don't know if it's just the UK-based market that has less kind of tempeh-based products. I don't know if it's more prevalent elsewhere in the world, or is it the same universally, do you think?
I'd say outside of Indonesia, which is obviously where tempeh originated, the UK, and I'd say probably the UK and the Netherlands are probably the two most advanced regions when it comes to their appreciation and understanding of tempeh, which is still very, very poor. If I go out, if I walk out of my flat and I run a survey, I'd probably, of 100 people that I interview, I reckon 5 would say, oh yes, I know what tempeh is. And maybe an additional 15 people say, oh yeah, I've heard of it, but don't actually know. Because when you start to quiz them about it, they can't give you an answer. They get confused with, say, tofu, for example. So I think there's a huge opportunity to be captured, not just in the UK, but in the rest of the world too.
Absolutely. I mean, just touching on the wider market in general, it's been reported that the Western world is nearly at tipping point with meat, and that by 2025 You know, it could be the point where the plant-based alternatives, you know, do take over and you know, meat starts to decline. Do you see that as a realistic time frame?
I want to believe that.
Mm.
I really do. But I think people still don't appreciate just how big meat is.
Mm.
And just how big the monster that we're trying to face is. You know, I think even with Pret and Subway and, you know, all these mainstream QSRs pushing the vegan message, vegan is still probably 2% of the total protein volume or less. 2% is probably the most optimistic, actually. I'd say it's like 1% of the total protein consumed by consumers today, whether it's in food service or retail. So to say that we're on the tipping point is a bit of an exaggeration.
It's a long road ahead.
But what I can say, right, is that the meat industry is built on very, very fragile ground. The machine that we have created over the last 100 years, really, of industrial meat production is incredibly sensitive to shifts in the market. And we know that from the dairy industry. You know, plant-based dairy is a huge success story, but it was decades in the making. You know, right now, plant-based dairy probably is about 15 to 20% of total, you know, milk sales.
Or, you know, you're allowed to call it that, but yes.
It's preposterous, but you know, whatever. Yeah, it is 15 to 20% of that market.
Mm.
And already I think it was like two of the top three, you know, don't quote me on this, you know, do your own research, but I'm not in the dairy space, but two, I think, of the three largest dairy producers or dairy processors in the US went bankrupt last year.
Wow.
Because of that shift in the top line demand.
Yeah.
You know, the machine is built on huge volume, and animal agriculture is so inefficient that you just need huge, huge, huge scale to make it in any way efficient, in any way affordable.
You know, and propped up by government subsidies as well.
Exactly, even with the subsidies. So though, yes, currently vegan protein is 1 to 2% of the market, perhaps this is what they meant by that tipping point. Perhaps if we grow penetration to any greater than 2%, we start the snowball effect whereby the production of meat is no longer profitable.
No. And I think the tipping point will come when the alternatives are as appealing as the meat products at the moment. And I think the way technology is moving and, you know, all the plant-based companies within this space, I think we are moving towards that at quite a pace. You know, just from my own experience, my brother's a diehard meat eater. I'm vegan. He's a diehard meat eater, and he came around for some food, and we fed him plant-based burger and didn't tell him, and it was that good that he didn't realize. So, you know, it's getting there, and I think it's almost that acceptance that people need, that acceptance to say, well, hang on, it is you know, taste wise comparable, and then it comes down to, you know, looking at the impact that meat has and taking it to an intellectual level, but, you know, to connect with people first of all, you know, on their relationship with meat. But it's certainly moving in the right direction, but I think, as you say, it's there's some way to go.
Absolutely. And there's so many, it is a long road ahead, but there's just the confluence of so many different factors is driving this unprecedented consumer behavior shift towards the greater and greater adoption of plant-based foods. I mean, it is the climate crisis, right? That The scientists have been telling us about for decades, you know, literally about 4 or 5 decades now, that we're just about waking up to. There's the biodiversity collapse sort of crisis, which is, I think, actually greater, but obviously related to the climate collapse. Mm. So the climate crisis, and obviously there's the health crisis as well that we find ourselves in. And with the studies published that show a direct correlation between, chronic health disorders and your susceptibility to pandemics, and obviously the relationship between the meat consumption and the origination of pandemics, I think that has opened a lot of people's eyes to eating plant-based meat, or eating meat alternatives, or just not eating meat, as a solution, as sort of the silver bullet to so many of the existential crises that we face as a species.
Absolutely. And in terms of the kind of ecological impact, just bringing it back to better nature, I know that you've been the world's first plastic neutral meat alternative brand. So I saw that. I was intrigued how you kind of got to that point ahead of some of the more established players.
It's honestly that we didn't look for plastic neutral to get that accolade.
Okay.
Like, that was not, we weren't screening, oh, what could be the world's first in, what, you know, we just wanted to do the right thing.
You were just following the ethics and the values of the company, and that's what came out.
Exactly. And it just turned out we were, which suggests to me, I don't know, it was in a way obviously great to have that accolade and to be able to shout about it, but also in a way slightly depressing that a 5-month-old brand can be the world's first in doing something that's environmentally friendly in an industry that in a large part is driven by sort of preaching, you know, the environmental sustainability message. So, because it wasn't difficult at all. You know, of all the things we've done today, it was probably, you know, it doesn't even create a signal of the challenges that we had to overcome.
It's just choosing the right supplier and working with the right materials.
It's, you know, it's not even that. It's just finding the right partner that was willing to offset our plastic. And then there's so many of them out there. And from a commercial perspective, it wasn't even that expensive.
No.
You know, and it didn't make a dent, really. It was a no-brainer. It was we didn't even have to consider it. It was just like, okay, wow, this is fantastic. So we've actually, you know, no one knows about this, and I'm not so sure if I should be telling this. So
go on,
Mark, you know, if this does go in and I get feedback from Ellen that I need to cut it out, then
absolutely,
we can do some magic.
Yes,
but,
I'm sure.
But, you know, assuming that I can talk about it, you know, we are doubling our commitment to go plastic negative.
Wow.
For our new range. So starting this month, we are going plastic negative. And we're taking one step further. We're going carbon negative as well. So we're offsetting 2 times the carbon that our products produce to be made from the environment. And I mean, okay, it helps that our products from a base perspective are very carbon efficient anyway.
Okay. Yes.
Right. It's obviously not beef. It's not cheese. It's not lamb. It's, you know, it's tempeh, which is very, very, has a very, very, very small climate impact.
Okay.
But we still wanted to do our bit, and, you know, doing our bit may not be enough, because meat consumption is still rising and the climate crisis, you know, as a member of the Western world that we have these luxuries that just other people don't. We need to be doing the heavy lifting, because we benefited from the system that we created. How can we tell a nation that's industrializing to say, oh no, you need to stop industrializing, when the UK pioneered industrialization, you know, in the early 19th century, in the 1800s? How can we say that and stop them from experiencing the rapid economic growth that brings? But what we can do is leverage the position that we're in and appreciate that we are, that we've got some serious work to do. And it has to be us. It can't be anyone else, because we're the only people that have the capacity to do a lot of this heavy lifting.
I think you're right. I think it's up to us in the Western world, isn't it, to lead the way. And I think the products that are in development now, will change the market forever. But there's no going back. So Chris, so just finally then, tell me a bit more about the new products at Better Nature in the future. What have you got lined up?
So our new range will be launching in June, as I mentioned earlier. Will include our barbecue ribs, so our southern style barbecue ribs, our smoky rashes, our sweet and smoky rashes, our traditional tender roast bites, and our shawarma spiced kebab strips. So those will be going out in June. And as for what we have in the pipeline for the future, we're toying a few ideas, but it will be truly exciting. And we're also working on our Better Matrix, which is effectively this ingredient that we've developed for ourselves that is made using tempeh fermentation. And I think tempeh fermentation will be a core element of Better Nature forever, but is made in such a way with our proprietary technology such that it barely resembles tempeh. Wow. As an end product, and is more akin to your hyper-realistic, meat alternatives.
Okay.
So our ambition with that product is to really offer protein without compromise, and to be able to offer consumers with great tasting meat alternatives that just so happen to also be all natural, and not to have to remove that compromise for our customers. So yeah, keep an eye out for that.
It's going to be Beyond Meat and those types of companies or products then, potentially.
I don't see this as a tit for tat battle against other plant-based meat brands. It's trying to grow the accessibility of the category, get new people to the shelf, stop preaching to the vegetarians and vegans, get more flexitarians in, get more meat eaters in. And only that way we'll be able to have, move the needle and have the impact that we're looking for in the aforementioned, multitude of problems that we face.
Well, I think if your list of products is anything to go by, my mouth's watering. I know it's lunchtime now, but I will definitely be watching the supermarket shelves and look forward to seeing Better Nature out there, and hopefully seeing you go on to bigger and better things. So exciting times.
Thank you so much, Mark. I'm looking forward to that as well.
Great stuff. Well, thanks very much for joining me, Chris, and hopefully we will speak at some point in the future.
Absolutely. And to your audience, if they want to get in touch with us here at Better Nature, the best place would be either through our LinkedIn, through my LinkedIn, so I'm Christopher Kong, through our website as well. You can message us directly there. If you want to stay up to date with what we're up to, please sign up to our newsletter. You can do that on our website. And please follow us on Instagram. You can follow us on @betternature_.
Absolutely. I will add all of those links so people can find you. But great stuff. Okay. Well, thanks again, Chris.
All right. Thank you so much, Mark.
Cheers.